beautiful day, we should be on the golf course, don't you think?
No, Bob, we have work to do.
Well, if that's what you call it, it's Bob McCowan, John Shannon with you on this program. If you're just listening, John is sucking on a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Black, no sugar.
Black, no sugar. Yeah.
I remember those days.
Well, when you used to get exercise or what?
No, when I used to have coffee.
But you don't drink coffee anymore?
I haven't had a coffee in probably 15, 20 years.
Okay, so there's more caffeine in tea, and you drink tea.
No, I don't think there's more caffeine. There is caffeine in tea. I don't think there's more.
Oh, I think there's more.
But I got off coffee because I had some sort of reaction to something.
Yeah.
And I had a rash that's
started. I remember.
And I stopped doing a whole bunch of things as we tried to figure out what was causing it. And one of the things I gave up was coffee. And just never went back.
Huh.
And
I thought you were just allergic to work.
Oh, that too.
Yeah.
But I couldn't quit work because I was married at the time. And one of the necessities of marriage is to bring in a sufficient income so that your spouse or spousal equivalent.
Don't go there. Spend. Do not go there. Do not go there. We don't want the lawyer's phone calls. Just don't go there.
They're
bills they're afraid of.
There's that. I'm watching the Blue Jays game last night.
Yes, sir.
And a decent job by Alek Manoah. And we've now seen three performances by him. One good, one not so good, and one pretty good.
Yeah.
And I think for a 22-year-old who has pitched almost not at all against professional hitters, you have to be pleased and optimistic about what we might see in the future.
I think optimistic's the right word. You know, and I think that Bob, you know the cycles of athletes. You know what happens. You get that first start, and it's better than anticipated, and it's emotional. And so the second start comes, and you know, the human aspect is that you're just not as prepared for the second one as you were for the first.
Yeah.
And there's that natural human letdown. So the third one, you know, as the learning curve, which is steep, the learning curve grows up, then it was bound to be an improvement, which I think is a really positive sign for this ball club. I really do.
Well, it would be nice if he could throw a few more innings. But
they got through it.
They managed to make a comeback and win 6-2.
Mm-hmm.
The other issue that came up on social media that we've talked about, and I've said this repeatedly, I think it was with Morosi specifically last week. Pitching is what you need, but that starting pitching is what everybody needs. And getting that before the trade deadline is not just difficult, it's almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, you can get fringe major league arms, and the Blue Jays went down that road. I think they have enough arms. They just don't have enough arms that are good enough. And those kinds of guys are almost impossible to get. But
unless you're prepared to
mortgage the future.
Sell an asset. That's right.
Well, or a bunch of assets. And I don't know about you, but I get the sense that this Blue Jay organization isn't quite ready to do that yet.
No. Well, and I'm not sure at this point, Bob, I'm not sure until I have all my home games in front of my home crowd, 35,000 people, I'm not sure I would. Honestly, I'm not sure I would. I think that has to become a factor in your decision making. Is that it becomes the, you know, a question of timing of when you do it. And I'm not there yet. I wouldn't do it until they're back in this country playing in front of big crowds and generating far more revenue.
One of the places where they appear to need help is at third base. And I only say appear because there are players in the system that can play at that position.
Mm-hmm.
and have big upside. What I don't understand right now is why Panic doesn't play more there. And I understand that offensively, he's not exactly what you want from a third baseman. You know, you want a guy who can hit you 25, 30 home runs. You want a guy who can get decent batting average, lots of RBIs, middle of the order kind of guy. That's your stereotypical third baseman. What Panic gives you is not that, but he gives you a solid glove, and he demonstrated it again last night with that leaping catch. Would you play him there more?
I mean, I know you've already said, I'd love his bat to be better. I really would want
him to be better. I think he's a short-term answer.
And if you're getting enough offense out of the rest of the order, then the answer is yes. And right now, they are.
You are.
Right now, yeah. So the answer for me, yes. But at what point, when everybody's healthy, with Biggio, Bichette, blah, 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 what point do you say, okay, listen, we have to make sure that we're investing in the future again, and we have to make sure one of these guys is playing in the proper position? Because they're not getting rid of those guys. And so that to me is part of that equation that I don't think they have the answer for it yet. I think they're waiting. There's going to be no epiphany of one of somebody that's a good hitter and a good defensive third baseman right now. They've got two guys.
Well, you got two dilemmas that are about to materialize. At some point, Springer's going to come back. Although
what did you say?
At some point. I don't know whether it's in our lifetime, but there was great speculation that he'd go to Buffalo/Trenton, wherever they're playing.
Trenton, yeah.
For a few games to get back in shape, and that would probably happen at the beginning of this week, and it isn't. It hasn't. He's still sitting on the bench. But at some point, he's going to come back, and that creates a dilemma in the outfield. Not with Davis, who is going to get sent down. That's almost assured. Right. But you're going to have four full-time outfielders who you'd like to play. And yeah, you can rotate them around the DH position. That means the end of Rowdy Tellez, I would assume. And then you're going to have Biggio come back. And Biggio could be your third baseman of the future, but he has been
spotty.
Defensively.
Yeah.
Yes.
Defensively. Well, that's my point. That's my point, Bob. I mean, I want Biggio in the lineup for his bat most of the time, but you know, this is not a teaching hospital. This is not a teaching position, a teaching time in Major League Baseball. I'm going to go out on the limb here. We're supposed to have Ross Atkins next week on the show. So this is,
won't answer any of these questions.
No, but we can badger him.
Well, we will badger him, but he won't answer the questions about what he's going to do. And we wouldn't expect it. And the audience shouldn't expect it. You know, you're not going to tell people in advance of what you do, what you're planning on doing.
No, but maybe we can read between the lines.
Well, let's try.
Okay.
That aside, our guest today is a friend. Good friend.
He might have some ideas about what the Blue Jays should do on the left side too.
I don't doubt that for a moment. Yeah. And there was a significant milestone that he reached yesterday.
Yeah.
Scotty Bowman will join us when we continue after these messages. It's Bob McCowan. It's John Shannon with you. And our guest joins us from, curiously enough, Buffalo, New York, which is the full-time home for Scotty Bowman. Although most often in the wintertime, we find him in Florida. Nice to see you. What's your hat?
Hockey Hall of Fame.
Hockey Hall of Fame hat. Very nice.
Very, very, it's very, Scotty's very subtle about things, you know.
Well, you couldn't guess it.
So you're in Buffalo, and while the break was on, we were just chatting. I know you're a big baseball guy, and the Blue Jays have, I think they've really been adopted by your hometown. Buffalonians seem to have become quite attached to having the Blue Jays around, no?
They are, Bob, and you know, it goes back. I don't know how many affiliations they've had, but this one, there's been some disagreements with the previous ones, but this one, they seem to, because of the proximity and the fact they had last year, but the Blue Jays have upgraded the stadium. It's as you know, I mean, I don't know if you've ever been down here. I actually had season tickets when I came to Buffalo. The park was built around the mid-80s, maybe, Bob Rich. And he had visions of a big league team at that time. 20,000 fans, 20,000 spectators can get in. And then there was a way that they could put another deck on top to make it 40. That was their dream back in the mid-80s. But, you know, now with the Blue Jays here, there's a lot of excitement. It's a great baseball town. And they love their Triple A. They love their Triple A team.
So, Scotty, you talk about that being a great baseball town, but if you were to sit on the patio at your golf course, would there be more Yankee talk or more Blue Jay talk?
Yankees.
Yeah.
It's a big Yankee. Yeah. Yankees are their team. Yeah. It's still there, but no, I think when you think about it, I followed them. I actually saw. It would be about 2 or 3 years ago when Guerrero was playing in New Hampshire and the Blue Jays brought him in late in the season. I went to some of their games. And I have a close friend of mine here whose wife is the daughter of a baseball scout for Buffalo, for Detroit Tigers a long time. He's a wonderful man. Cy Williams, he passed away, but I got watching games with him, and that's a long time ago. He used to go in the mid-80s, but he's a scout for the Tigers for a long, long time. And so there's a lot of interest. Warren Spahn, this man, Cy Williams, grew up with him. Mm. He's from South Park, not just a suburb of Buffalo. So there's a lot of baseball interest.
I'll be interested to see. And I know last year the Blue Jays, while they played their home games in Buffalo, there were no fans in attendance. So that makes a big difference. And now you're seeing for the first time fans in the ballpark, and there appear to be about as many as they will allow. So ticket sales don't seem to be problematic. Wouldn't surprise me at all if once they raise the limit, you see 15,000 in there. But there's a thing about having a visiting team play in your town when you don't have major league sports. You get possessive. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden now you want more of it. And I think Buffalo's going to be in withdrawal when the Toronto Blue Jays leave and come back to Toronto, don't you think?
Yeah, I think they're guaranteed up to maybe the All-Star game. It looks like that could be it. And the Bisons are playing in Trenton. And I'm not sure, Bob, if they would be coming back, of course.
Yes.
They'd be coming back in mid-July. So, yeah, it's spiked the interest. But right now, with the weather being so pretty nice right now, the Blue Jays stayed in Dunedin. And I know people down there, they said it was really getting pretty uncomfortable without having any air conditioning or anything. And it's too hot. So it was good they came here. And Bob Rich has owned this team a long time. And he's a great owner for sports in Buffalo. And it's good. I'm very happy that they came.
Well, yesterday marked the 50th anniversary of your arrival with the Montreal Canadiens. I'm intrigued by your memories of that day and the whole process of you becoming the head coach of the Montreal Canadiens.
It was very good timing, Bob. I think it was a Monday when they announced that I was going to be the coach, and the draft was on Tuesday, the next day. And that's the famous draft of Guy Lafleur with the number one pick from Oakland. And I attended my first meeting Monday night. It lasted into the wee hours of the morning. Sam Pollock was the general manager, and there was myself, Claude Ruel, Al McNeil, Ronnie Caron, a couple of other scouts. And the talk was who we're going to draft. And I didn't participate very much in it, although I'd been with St. Louis and I'd left them about a month earlier. And it was all about Guy Lafleur and Marcel Dion. It's quite a story. And Sam Pollock had been on the phones with Ned Harkness, I'm sure, was in Detroit. And Sam was very thorough, and he had a deal on the table, which meant the Canadians had just upset Boston and won the Stanley Cup, as you know, Ken Dryden coming in. And it was a trade to get Marcel Dion. I know it involved one of the Stanley Cup defensemen. It was going to be either Terry Harper or Jean-Claude Tremblay. That was the first part of the deal. There was a draft pick in there, and there was some young players, as many young players, two or three. And I think it was pretty close to being made, but Sam couldn't convince everybody that it was the right thing to do. And what he did, the question he asked was, could this be another decade of Jean Béliveau and Bernie Geoffrion, Boom Boom Geoffrion, because they had gone through the 50s, both came up through the ranks of junior, and couldn't get an affirmative answer from everybody. and they felt that, see, Marcel was the best, he won the scoring in the Ontario League. And I've read a lot of stories about him. And I did go to a game in St. Catharines the year before the draft. I was with St. Louis, and I met a wonderful man who used to write for the Freeholder there, Jack Gatecliffe. And I used to go in, I went in the press box. I went to see Reja Houl and Mark Tardif playing for the junior Canadians, and talking to Jack, and he said, look at number five, watch number five for this team. He said, he's been a better junior here than Stan Mikita and Bobby Hull. That's what he said at the time. And Mikita, of course, Marcel got drafted by Detroit, but it was very close that he could have been a Montreal Canadian.
Oof, wait, well, and Jack Gatecliffe, just as an aside, I've spent lots of time with my son playing hockey in St. Catharines, and one of the arenas is named after Jack Gatecliffe now. So he was a huge hockey resource in the Niagara Peninsula. But this is my question to you, Scotty. You had gone to the Stanley Cup final in 68, 69, 70. You didn't go in 71. No. Because they had realigned Vancouver Buffalo came in, realigned it. That means Bill Wirtz got the gift of having the best team in the Western Conference. So you didn't get to the Stanley Cup final. Why did you leave St. Louis? What was going on in St. Louis? You obviously had success, but there was a bit of a revolving door there at that point. There wasn't there.
Well, we like you said, we missed the first 3 years. The father owner, Sid Solomon Jr., was a wonderful owner, but he got impatient, and we're into the fourth season, and you lose 3 years in a row, even though you're an expansion team and you're outclassed for sure. And somehow he got a burr in his side about Red Berenson. And I think it started with the fact that when Red scored 6 goals for us, for St. Louis, in Philadelphia, they gave him a car, and Red was upset about getting the car, and he sold it to Dan Kelly 2 weeks later. He said that the car wasn't given by the team; it was given. I mean, I could see his point. We weren't selling out, and we sold out that night. So I think that was the start of it. And first, I mean, being the owner of the team, it's his right. And Red had a good, I mean, he had a slow start the fourth season, that season. But he always had a pretty decent season. And he was really our best player, our best forward by quite a bit. And Mr. Solomon wanted to know he asked me one day, is this team going to ever win the Stanley Cup? And I had to be honest about it. And I said, no, we have to rebuild it because we were getting old. We had old players anyways. We picked up old players, and that's why we did so well. And anyways, he pushed and pushed and came back one day and from a meeting and said, like he he said, you know, Philadelphia is really interested in Red Berenson. And I said, well, what are they going to give us, you know? He said, well, what do you think of Bernie Perron? I said, no chance. No chance. I said, he's their franchise. So, no. He said, you call. I was good friends with Keith Allen. When I was in Montreal, he used to get players from Canadians when he was out west. Mm-hmm. And I called him up and I said, you know, Mr. Solomon was talking to somebody there and it looks like, you know, you're interested in Red Berenson. He said, yeah, well, what do you want? I said, well, Keith, he's mentioned Bernie Perron. He said, are you smoking something? And that was the end. That was the end of that story. I came home. I said, no chance. I said, they're not trading him. He's their franchise. And a couple of weeks later, Detroit Red Wings. What do you think of Gary Unger? I said, well, he's a good young player. He's 10 years younger. But at the same time, you know, he's not where Red Berenson is right now. The playoffs coming up. And, you know, I said, I don't think it's going to be that good a deal right now because, you know, we still got a pretty good chance in the fourth season. And I said, if you don't care about the playoffs. No, I don't care about the playoffs. I said, we want to rebuild the team. Well, we made that trade and we got beat by Minnesota. Red was a great player for us. And that was the beginning of the end. We lost. Then at the end of the next day, they asked me all kinds of stuff. They said Glenn Hall was not going to be the goalie anymore. Al Arbor, we put him in as coach, but he came back and played that year. I only put him back in. I said, I told the owner, if he comes back and plays, he's got to make sure that he coaches next year because I didn't want to coach anymore at that time. So it was just a misfit for everything. Cliff Fletcher, they didn't like Cliff Fletcher. It was just everything was going wrong. So I made a mistake and I had a contract and I said, you know, I saw Mr. Solomon a day later and he wanted me to get rid of these guys. And I said, Mr. Solomon, I got upset and I probably never should have done it. But I said, very seldom, if they go, I go. And I had 37 months on my contract. And I got a call that night from his son and he said, you know, nobody talks to my dad that way. And he said, come in tomorrow morning and visit with Jim Cullen. And I went in to see the lawyer. I was shocked. And he said, you know, you've resigned. I said, no, I haven't resigned. I said, I just told him the conversation and I didn't know what to do. So I was really upset. I went home. I told my wife, I said, we're probably not going to stay here. And I phoned Clarence Campbell. I give him a lot of credit. He was the president of the league. And I said, Mr. Campbell, I said, I want to ask you a question. I said, could I ask you a legal question? And he said, yes. I said, the team is saying that I quit. And I said, here's the situation. Well, he said, I'll take off my president's hat and I'll put on my lawyer's hat. And I'll tell you that resignation is not final unless it's offered in writing and accepted in writing. But he said, I'll give you a piece of advice. You're not going to be too long to stay there. I would get the best lawyer you can and make sure. So that's the story. And that's why I left. And I got a year out of the contract. And then Montreal had the problem with Al McNeil and Al and I are good friends. And the rest is history.
What a great story. So interesting. I assume you were more, you know, you go from St. Louis, who was an expansion franchise, obviously, although they had success, relatively speaking, as an expansion franchise, to an historic franchise. What was your relationship with Sam like at that time?
Well, he was looking, I had played for him. I had coached with him. I'd worked 10 years with him. And then he said, and I talked to Charlie Finley in Oakland and Jack Kent Cook in Los Angeles and a couple of normal guys. Well, they went all the way out to Los Angeles, and then Canadians had that issue with the coach and everything. And Sam called me and said, "Look, would you like to come here for a year?" So thinking that I wasn't going to be maybe a coach, and I said, let me think about it. And I said, it made a lot of sense. So I came to Montreal in 1971 thinking that I would, you know, it was a good place, thinking the team's going to be okay. It's starting to draft young players. It'd be a good place to jump off. I didn't think I was going to stay there the full 8 seasons. I was just went there because he offered me a job with a pretty good team as going home. And my parents were still living and I had to go somewhere. And I didn't feel like going to Oakland or into California. I just didn't think it was the right thing at that time. So that's how I got to Montreal. I didn't think I was going to stay.
The interesting thing is that, and maybe my memory's going a little wacky, but there was lots of rumors about you always ending up back in Montreal. You know, because of all those years of being part of the franchise, whether it be all the way back to coaching in Peterborough, right?
Yeah, they were all farm teams. Yeah,
yeah, but that was almost to me as a young guy a given that you would end up with Canadians.
Well, when I went to St. Louis, Lynn Patrick was a close friend of Sam Pollock, and I had a year left on my junior Canadian contract, and Lynn called me and said, would you ever think of coming to expansion? The league's going to expand. And I said, well, I have a year left on my contract with the junior Canadians. And, you know, I wasn't thinking about going. And he said, well, let me talk to Canadians. And he called Sam and they met. And he said, I got a chance to get a coach to be. I was going to coach the second year. I was going to be assistant the first year. So Sam, I mean, you know, I'd worked 10 years for him. And Toe Blake is coaching in Montreal, so it didn't look like Toe was going to leave at all. So I probably thought at the time, I got a chance if I keep coaching junior and he ever quits at one time, I would get a shot at it. But I never really thought about it seriously when I got the chance to go to St. Louis. I mean, wow, I was 33 and chance to be with an NHL team and be a coach the second year. That's why I went there. But Sam, he said, look, come here because, you know, if you want to get back into the managing side and, you know, you can jump from here if you want, but let's do it for a year. But Sam knew I could speak French and it was a big issue and he knew I had coached junior. So it was a big issue in Montreal at the time. So that's the reason I got back to Montreal.
Nothing's changed, Scotty. It's still a big issue.
Yeah. Why were you such a reluctant coach, if I'm reading the tea leaves correctly?
Reluctant to coach, you mean rather than be a manager, you mean?
Yeah, or? I think, you know, you're making it pretty clear that your preference would have been to be in, you know, upstairs in the front office rather than behind the bench.
Well, I did, yeah, in St. Louis, I did it for, after the first year, I did it for the next 3 years. And, you know, I knew it was too much doing both jobs because you're gonna gravitate to one or the other. And what I did is I didn't mind the managing, trying to get things going, but I spent more time coaching and I had Cliff Fletcher to help me. So I had the best of both worlds. So I never really, and then when I left Montreal, the reason I left is I got a chance to get two jobs again. I mean, you know, I had a young family and I it's like anything else, Bob. I mean, I got a big contract in Buffalo to go there. I mean, they needed the Buffalo Sabres needed the voting trust again. That was a team that was owned by a lot of people. And Punch Imlach went in 1970 and the Knoxes got the voting trust for 10 years. And then when he was removed in 78, I think they looked at me and said, you know, I'm pretty sure they got the voting trust for because the league doesn't want to deal with a lot of people. No. They want to deal just with a couple of people. So I went from Montreal to St. Louis and I more than doubled my salary and I had a young family. My wife was from the US. Canadians, we did okay in Montreal because I had all my friends and family, but it was getting the political stuff didn't bother us because I'm with the Montreal Canadiens. I'm coaching their team, but it wasn't easy for my wife and she never said anything about it. But the chance to go into the US, stay close to Canada. I had a chance to go to Buffalo, Toronto and Washington. And that was the three areas that I could have gone to Toronto I talked a lot with Harold Ballard, but never offered me a contract. And Buffalo, I had the best of both worlds. I felt if you're going to stay in hockey, Canada was the place, but Buffalo was so close, I'd be able to keep up my hockey, IQ.
So actually, we've talked about this before, but I've always fascinated. So Sam retired in, I believe, 78.
Yeah,
I
think, 1 year left. Yeah,
and ownership put Irving Grundman as the managing director. How much did that bother you?
It bothered me a lot because I knew how successful Montreal was because of Sam's acumen being more than just a manager. He was able to get players. He was able to build. He'd been doing it for a long time. So what I was concerned about, we did sort of sneak out the cup in 79 because we were so close to losing to Boston. We had a good group of players, but the future, I was concerned. If they would have been interested at that time, like the best two managers at the time were Harry Sinden and Emil Francis. Mm-hmm. And I kind of said, Sam was like, he was the number one guy, but if they would have brought in a good manager to do what he did, I think I could have stayed, but I just felt that it wasn't going to work. I said, I mean, it wasn't so much I would have liked to have been the manager, but not so much. I would like to coach, but I'd like to get a manager, but I just didn't have confidence that this thing was going to work. And then Buffalo came after me I had no more contract with Montreal, so Buffalo, I was going to have to negotiate. So what Buffalo offered me, I couldn't turn it down.
So I'm trying to get to the point here. You said it was there was an economic reality here, and obviously having two jobs pays better. You seem to like the idea of being in the front office and having control of the franchise.
More job security, Bob. More job security.
And more job security. But did you dislike coaching? Were you bored with coaching? Or
no, too much. I when I got to Buffalo, when I left Buffalo, when they called me in 87, it was, if I didn't want to coach, then I couldn't stay. And I got fired by Buffalo because I wouldn't coach. It's wow. Crazy. But no, I brought in different guys, but I never could get it. They always wanted me to, they wanted me as a coach. When I think back of it, I don't think they were worried about being a manager as much as a coach. So I enjoyed the coaching better than the managing because you're it's competitive. You're every day you're with the team. I gravitated to that, and that's what I enjoyed the best.
Well, I've been around you enough in the last 40 years, Scotty, to know that you loved the mind games of being a coach. Whether it was the tactics of the other coach or the other team, or even the mind games you would play on your own guys.
it was more fun coaching than managing, and I was more suited to it. So that's exactly what I did. It was an awful job when you try to do two jobs because you don't do both. Actually, you don't do both of them justice because you have to. I eventually gravitated to coaching and the managing I left to somebody else. But you can't. It doesn't work. I mean, I think I enjoyed what I coming to Buffalo. I mean, I stayed here and we raised a good family here, but. At the same time, I would like to have been able to build. I mean, I was disappointed. You know, I was looking the other day at a list of players that have scored goals or something since I don't know how long. And two of them on the list, we drafted in Buffalo, Andrejczyk and Housley.
Yeah.
And we could never get it done in Buffalo because we had very good young players, but we had no core. And to get the young players, and I look back, to get the young players, we had to trade some players that were near the end of the line. And I traded at the second or third year, I traded two very popular players, Jim Schoenfeld and Danny Gare to Detroit to get Mike Foligno. And then we traded Rick Martin, who was he was sort of sliding a bit, but we traded him to get a draft pick from Los Angeles, who it turned out to be Tom Barrasso, and we traded Jerry Korab, and he turned out to be Phil Housley. But at the same time, we didn't have the veteran players, and that we had good young players in Detroit. And I looked at my days in Buffalo. We got 100 points. We were battling Montreal, Boston. Quebec was coming pretty good. They were getting strong. And we never had really bad years, but you can't win in this league without, and it's been proven right now when you look at Montreal. I mean, it's a team with some reject, not rejects, but, you know, the Corey Perrys and Toffolis of the world are probably the reason now that this team is stabilized. And but we never, I don't think you can just have an all young team. Edmonton's the only team that proved it, really, that the young players can develop, and they were superstars.
We got to take a quick break. We'll come back with more. Scotty Bowman is with us, back after these. It's Bob McCowan. It's John Shannon, and Scotty Bowman is with us from his home.
This is the quietest you and I have been in a long time, Bob.
Well, we're never bored when Mr. Bowman is with us.
Hey, Scotty, that first year you coached in Montreal, you and the Flower together, Guy Lafleur was, I mean, they've retired number four for the whole Quebec Major Junior League. Now that's how good he was. But he did not really reach his potential that first year, did he? And how much pressure was there on you to get him to that level?
Guy had a different temperament. You know, he came in from Quebec City. The pressure was insurmountable. He wore number four in Quebec. Beliveau was number four with Canadians. He was coming in to replace Beliveau, Jean Beliveau. It was an impossible task for any player. He was a centerman. The league had some really good centermen, the Clarks and all these guys, Esposito, Rattel, Kachuk, so I can name about five or six of them. And it just, you know, he had a hard time because the Canadians were the third best team in 71. When they won the cup, when Ken Dryden came in and they won the cup, they were a long range third best. The best team was Boston, and the second best was the Rangers. They were really good teams. But that year was a tough year when I came back and we're breaking in Guy. They won the Stanley Cup the year before. Beliveau's no longer with the team. I mean, it was a big trend. And John Ferguson had just retired. So, you know, there was a lot of pressure on him to succeed. And don't forget, Richard Martin had gone to Buffalo, and he had picked up with Guy, with Gilbert Perreault. And it was a tough time for Guy. And we're trying to win, and we're trying to develop players. And, you know, we moved them from the center to the wing. He didn't flourish till, and don't forget, Yvan Cornway was in his prime. He was the number one right winger on our team and pretty close to number one in the league. So, and Claude LaRose was still there, good defensive player. You're trying to win games. He didn't play the same time and minutes as some of these other draft picks. And the comparison is always made on a draft pick. How good is he? Well, I'll tell you what happened. And after his third season, no, it would be his second season, because in the 73 finals, we played Chicago.
Right.
And Claude Ruel and myself were called down from being up in the Laurentian Mountains to Montreal early in the afternoon of one of the games, because Sam Pollock was negotiating with the Lafleur's camp. It was Jerry Patterson and Jerry Petrie, and he was negotiating a contract because Lafleur was offered, his future wife, Lise Barre, his father-in-law, Roger Barre, was a director of the Nordiques. And they offered him 3 years at $150,000. He was offered $450,000 to sign with the Nordiques the next year. And I'm sure he was, I don't think he was, maybe not married, but that was his girlfriend. And it was Sam Pollock come up with $1 million for 10-year contract. And he called us down and asked us, how good is he going to be? Is he worth $100,000? Well, it was a tough question because he was making $35,000. And he jumped from $35,000 to $1 million for 10 years. It turned out to be a tough contract for him, for both parties later on, but that's history. And Sam decided, I'll give him $100,000. I think Frank Mahovlich was the only player on the team making more than that. And it was a tough call. It was a tough call, but he wanted to know how good he was going to be. And I mean, I remember it because Claude Ruel, he just finished his second year, and he still wasn't a star. I mean, is he going to be a star? Honestly, I didn't think he'd ever do what he did as a coach. I mean, you know, players flourish, and Claude Ruel brought up a name of a player to him because Sam was pushing Claude and saying, well, what kind of a player is he? And he said, right now he's a lot like a Bob Nevin type. He can score, he's not really a defensive player right now because he came from the Quebec Junior League. So it was amazing. Then he just took off. I mean, because Ivan was getting on a little bit more, but Guy didn't play as much. He didn't. I mean, we gave him as much time as we could, but we didn't treat him like a guy coming in and give him the keys to the kingdom for sure.
One of the things, I don't know whether the audience has picked up on this. I don't know if Shani has, but in just listening to you talk and casually rattle off names of Montreal Canadiens players that were around you or in the organization, you get a realization of exactly how powerful the Montreal Canadiens were when you were there and in the era before you took over as head coach. So I'm gonna ask you an extremely unfair question, Mr. Bowman. Rank the five best Montreal Canadiens, in your opinion, of all time.
Well, I mean, I got the first. I mean, I was only there from the 50s on. I mean, I have to put Doug Harvey. Doug Harvey and Rocket are the two that first come to my mind.
Okay.
No question about that. And it's not easy after that because there's a lot of players. I mean, I got to put, when I'm thinking about it now, Guy Lafleur's got to go probably right there with Béliveau. Béliveau would have to go next for sure on what he did for longevity and, winning all those championships. And he was a, Bello has never been given, when they rate all the players in the NHL, I don't know where he rates, but he was such a great player from the time he was 16 to the time he was 40. Yeah. And Béliveau would have to go three. I would go to Guy Lafleur four. And it's so hard to pick that fifth guy because, you know, when you're going through the defense core, you're going through some really top guys. You're going through Henri Richard. What a player he was.
What about Serge?
Serge Savard and Larry Robinson were two peas in a pod. They played together. They were different types. And a lot of people that played against Serge would put him right there. I think Henri Richard, because of his, the way he played, the way he carried himself, boy, what a player he was. I had him only at the end of his career, but he still was the captain of the Stanley Cup team in 73. And he played from 55 as a teenager. That would be my five.
11 cups, huh? For Henri, is that right? Am I?
Cornway's got 10 and Henri has the most, 11.
11, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, You can be a passenger on a couple of Stanley Cups, but you can't be a passenger for 11 of them. He was an impactful player who played in the shadow of his older brother.
And not only that, Bob, and Scotty can deal with this. I mean, Henri Richard was not the biggest guy.
Oh, he's tiny.
You know, the pocket rocket.
He was physically strong for his size. He was short, but he had strong lower body. The two players that played in that era were two of the smaller players in the league, and they played a lot against each other and two good teams, Dave Keon and Henri Richard. Yeah. Makita would be the next smallest player, maybe of stature, that played so great in the NHL for small players. But Henri and Keon, you know, they played a lot against each other, but a lot of times they didn't play against each other because Keon played a lot against Belleville.
So since we've gone down this rabbit hole, I must ask you then, goaltenders. Plante, Dryden, Roy.
Yeah, they had terrific goaltending.
Who was the best of that?
Price. Carey Price too now. He's
been there for
13 years. So, no, to me, it's Dryden's record is impeccable because he lost in seven regular seasons, he lost 58 games. He lost an average of 8 games a year, and he won an average of 33. And his playoff record would be just as good because he won 6 cups, and he only played 7 regular seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, it's going to be, if you look at his games played, 398, and he lost 58 games. It's hard to believe people say, well, yeah, but he had all those Hall of Fame players.
Yeah.
So, I mean, a goalie's part of the team. Any goalie on any team, in some part of the game, he's going to have some power plays against them, or he's going to have, you know, it's not going to be easy. So, I have a hard time. I mean, Jacques Plante, I mean, I had Jacques at 40. He was a tremendous goaltender. I mean, he did have some quirks about him with the mask and then the injuries, but boy, I mean, the team, you know, to be rated in the top three all the time, Sochuk, you know, when they're looking at Sochuk, Hall, and Plante, you're in pretty big company.
Yeah. So I it's funny when we talked yesterday about coming on. One of the things that tweaked me to have you come on was that yesterday at practice in Montreal, Canadians are preparing for their next round, and Marc Bergevin phones Bob Gainey and has Bob Gainey come and talk to the team and was on the ice with the team yesterday. And I assume to instill some of that great Canadians mentality, championship philosophy. That must have put a little smile on your face.
Yeah. I mean, he was Bob. I didn't have him as the captain, but you know, he was a draft pick that turned into be a Hall of Fame player, which nobody else would have drafted at the time. He developed himself. He was one of the players on the team, the core players that you don't win if you don't have those kind of players. You can have a lot of scoring, but I mean, he's not always knocking out the best player on the other team because of his defensive abilities. And, you know, he was a solid character guy. And so I could see Bergevin. I could see Mark because I know him. I mean, I traded for him as a player with the Red Wings and did a pretty good job for us. And I had worked with him in Chicago. So, you know, you're touching all the bases. And you're, you know, because I think he's looking ahead and saying, you know, we've got a lot going for us, but we've got an uphill battle coming up in the next round. But so is some of the other teams that they had before. So it's a big story because even the night that Evans got injured, I always look at ice times and they're pretty accurate right now. They weren't always that way. And the player that played the most on the forwards that night was Jake Evans.
Mm-hmm.
He played seven. I always look at Montreal's ice time now because I look at their team. And you know, a few guys, I was surprised that one of the, not the, th- I think the second or third game, Josh Anderson had 10 or 11 minutes. The last game, Eric Staal was the lowest at 12, but the highest was always 16 or 17. So that's why successful now.
Spreading it out.
The playoffs, Bob, you cannot play and win in the playoffs without a full deck. And that's what they have. They have a full deck. You look around the room and you don't have to worry. The guy next to you doesn't have to score tonight, or the guy on the left doesn't have to be the best penalty killer, because you got, if he doesn't do it, the guy next to him will do it. And that's what the Islanders are doing, the same thing. The Islanders, I mean, they, you know, people don't know guys. They don't know Nelsons, and they don't know, all they hear about is Barzal. I understand last night they looked at the end of the game, Barzal had 10 minutes. Mm. They gave his ice time 3 minutes in the first period, 4 in the second, and 2 in the third, 2 something in the third. Well, Barry Trotz has got a lead, and he's going to play his players. And that's, I did the same thing. I mean, you know, people would wonder, why do you play Jimmy Roberts so much? Why do you play Jarvis Gainey? But the reason that those teams win, I mean, it's no different in any team I've been with, but the Montreal team with, okay, Gainey was a Hall of Famer, but that was a controversial pick, I mean, because he didn't have the scoring, but Jarvis, Riseborough, Lambert, Trombley, Houle, Roberts. Now you've got, when I go to Detroit, Draper, Maltby, Koser, these kind of players. I don't think you win the cup if you don't have those kind of players.
No, you don't.
I look at it now, and I'm watching Vegas play now, and they're playing Pat Brown, Doug Brown's son. He's been in the minors most of his career. They're playing Roy. You know, they're playing Carrier. They're playing them at the right time. And every team has to have those kind of players. And that's why the series, when we end up with the fourth team after this series is over, it's going to be, I mean, the defense are all big. Look at Tampa's defense. Look at the Islanders' defense. You know, I mean, all of a sudden these teams are getting in. I mean, the only team that doesn't have a huge defense, maybe, but they're different because they're so skillful, is Colorado. They're not big. They're not big like the other teams. You know, Islanders guys are big. Pulak and Pelic and Mayfield. These are big guys.
We that we can talk to you forever and ever. Amen. And we would like to, but time is a bit of an enemy here for us on this program. So we're going to let you go. Stop looking so good, for God's sakes. You look exactly the same as you did 20 or 30 years ago, and maybe even earlier than that. I don't remember how long we've been chatting, but it's been a long time.
Well, so I still love the game. I love the game, and I love the playoffs, and I can't wait. I like it better now when there's only one game you have to watch, because it's tough to watch. But I found out now you can only watch one game at a time and do a good justice to it. But I think you're going to have a terrific final. We're going to have a great final, but we're going to have a big, this semifinal is going to be so good.
So, I'm going to do this to Bob. Sorry. One question. Tugging at the heartstrings if Montreal gets through? Like, are you still a Montreal? Is there a little bit of Montreal in you, Scotty?
I got a lot of Montreal when the playoffs, but I have a lot of Detroit.
Yeah.
I have a hard time. If they ever played, I'd have to watch baseball.
Okay. Well, you got all summer to do that. And at least a while to be able to do it in person in Buffalo with the Blue Jays. You know, we love having you on, and we'll bug you in the not too distant future again.
Okay, thank you, boy. Scotty. Thank you. Bye.
The legendary Scotty Bowman, back after these messages. So, McCowan, it's Shannon. Well,
it always puts a smile on my face.
Well, it should. It does mine too.
Now, have you noticed with Scotty, and I noticed this with my great old friend, the late Danny Gallivan, he never puts the word "the" in front of the team nickname in Montreal. He always says
Montreal Canadiens.
Canadiens. And that dates back to when they had two teams in town, Maroons, Canadiens. And that's part of the old fashioned tradition. If you listen to the play-by-play of Danny Gallivan through the 60s and 70s, it was always Canadiens come up the ice. It was never the Canadiens come up the ice. And Scotty does the exact same thing all through that interview. Every time he says, well, you know, when I was with Canadiens, There's no, he never puts the word "the" in front of the team nickname. It's fascinating.
I didn't notice it, but I will look for it in our future conversations, of which I hope there are many.
Oh, there will be.
That'll do it for us. We're back tomorrow with another program. Hope you'll...
Bill Daly tomorrow. Promise.
Well...
Promise.
Keep our fingers crossed.
Yeah.
He canceled on us once already.
Yeah, postponed. It was a pause.
Yes, it was a weather problem, I'm sure. Until then, keep your hat dry. For Shannon McCowan, see you tomorrow.